Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. In tonight's episode, Peephole Geographies, we search near and far for examples of seeing the world through a narrow opening. Not a narrow world, but one perhaps far from our reach. Not unreachable, though, either, but one we can travel to with the aid of visual images. This episode brings the local, by speaking with a local artist and local art historians, to key discussions about how we learn about space and place, and how our geographical imagination is formed. We have two segments tonight. First, I take a short expedition to the Salzburg Museum. Microphone in hand, I explore one of the remaining extant panorama paintings from the mid-19th century. Guided by Drs. Renata Lagenfelder and Deborah Gatewood, we examine a pre-film, pre-movie, and mostly pre-photography, realistic representation of the city of Mozart. And second, I come back to the studio to discuss the pinhole camera technique and time space with Austrian photographer and artist Patrick Schaudy. Put on your walking shoes. This is Geographical Imaginations. So right now we are actually inside the Salzburg Panorama, and we want to talk a little bit about who painted this and why.
The artist of the panorama is Johann Michael Sattler. He was an artist who was born in Lower Austria, and he was trained to paint as a portraitist in Vienna, and he moved to Salzburg about 1719 with his family. He was, as I said, trained as a portraitist, but he took on this commission to paint the panorama because the Emperor Franz I of Austria, who was visiting Salzburg around 1824, asked him to paint a panorama of the city. He was very impressed with the beauty of Salzburg and also with the abilities of Sattler as a painter. Interestingly enough, though, the Emperor did not provide him with any funds to carry out the project. But that was his first impetus as a painter.
So it wasn't a commission necessarily, a commissioned work by the emperor. But why did he want it? What was his purpose in wanting to paint a panorama of Salzburg?
The emperor. Well, it was not the first panorama. There were others. And so as an emperor, he had probably seen a panorama of London or to Edinburgh, some other panoramas. And he just thought that this practically new property of his was worthy of being painted for its majestic beauty. And Salzburg had changed hands many times throughout the early 19th century, and it had become part of the Austrian Empire about 1816. And so that may have been a reason that he had a special interest, in addition to the fact that he liked Sattler as a painter.
Interesting. So maybe actually asking to have it painted was kind of claiming it as his own territory in some ways and celebrating that.
Yes, it was his territory. Salzburg was not in a phase of glamour like it had been in previous centuries. It had lost its power as an independent principality, and it was really what you would call almost a county seat to the emperor when he visited in the 20s. And for that reason, he may have been very proud of it.
Explain a little bit what this room looks like.
Well, we are at the Panorama Museum. It was especially designed for this painting. And basically, you are in a room that emulates the original rotunda. We are in a circular room, a cylinder, and we've walked up onto a platform into the room. Some people asked, did we cut a door into the painting? We did not. Sattler actually designed the doorway to be there. And now we are standing on the platform looking at the painting. It's 29 meters long, and it's 5 meters high, And so that gives you an idea of the scale. And basically you turn around on this circular panorama platform and you have a 360 degree view of Salzburg, which is very convincing. And this, of course, was something completely new for its time, especially when the painting traveled to places like Amsterdam, to the lowlands or places where people had never seen such a landscape. It made an immense impression on them.
Right. So, yeah, we're seeing the north side of the Alps with Untersberg, kind of a sacred mountain in the history and lore of the region. And we see, where are we actually looking from? Where was his vantage point in painting?
Yes. If you'll notice, the fortress of Salzburg is conspicuously absent from the painting. And the reason is that he used that as the vantage point for his painting. And he spent 8 months on the fortress of Salzburg making tomes, really, of sketches for his painting. He did them all by himself, and he used a grid paper base to ensure that they were perspectivally accurate. He really wanted to be accurate and not just anecdotal in his portrayal of the city. And for that reason, as I said, you don't see the fortress. One thing that's interesting is that also a lot of people from Salzburg during this time had probably not had the opportunity to go to the fortress, or not very often, because it was a military bastion at the time. It wasn't open to the public like it is today.
So it really kind of offered this perspective that no one really had access to by being on top of the fortress.
Very few people would have had access to that, yes.
Right, interesting. Yeah, we really get the detail here is quite amazing. I mean, down to farm animals, smoke coming from chimneys, the shadow in the old town casting over a little bit, the river. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Today we're out at the Salzburg Museum. Let's go back and talk more about the panorama. When would the panorama have been open to the public, in the sense that the public could view it? When would that have happened?
Well, Sattler started the painting or drawings for the panorama in 1825, and the first time the public in Salzburg would have seen it would have been in 1829. It was Easter Monday that year, so it was in April. And shortly thereafter, in June, he took the painting on tour and started traveling throughout Europe for 10 years. But yes, and so in 29 was the first time that his own city was able to see the painting.
And do we know how it was seen in the first instance, and what kind of venue, in what kind of building?
Yes. Well, if you think about it, the panorama is huge, and he couldn't paint it in a normal home. He had built a special rotunda for it that he put behind his house on Marktplatz here in Salzburg. And so he used this collapsible, movable rotunda with a copper roof to actually paint the painting in with his colleagues. He had two painters who helped him. And then he took this little rotunda with him as a moving museum or moving pavilion that he traveled with. So when he carried the painting, he always took the little hut with him. And we know that from descriptions of the time that Sattler actually decorated the little pavilion, and he used, for instance, velvet curtains and colorful cloth to make it more appeasing to the guests and to give it a sort of noble quality. So
good. And then when it traveled around Europe, you said in 10 years, so he traveled with this small building and brought that with him as well.
Yes, he traveled with the rotunda. He took the painting. He would roll it up and reinstall it in all of the sites that he visited. And we think that he was carrying as much as 30 tons with him when he traveled. He traveled by ship. He traveled over land. He traveled with his entire family along with the painting. And he had a carpenter who helped him set up the exhibition in the different cities that he traveled in. We think that he traveled about 30,000 kilometers during that 10 years period of time, and he would have set the exhibition up in about 20 or more different locations.
Any estimation of how many people might have seen it?
Unfortunately, I don't know how many people would have visited. We know that it was very popular, though. It was affordable enough for a common person to visit the panorama. The entrance fee was about 10 to 20 kreutzer. So, I don't know, maybe a couple of euro, not so expensive. And in addition, not just the common man, but also he had special guests, like when they were in Bavaria, in Munich, in 1829, on one of his first steps, one of his first stops, Ludwig I of Bavaria visited the panorama. And we also know that, for instance, Franz I, the emperor, visited the panorama in Vienna. And so this got a lot of attention in the newspaper and made it a very popular thing to do because of these special guests, these nobility VIPs.
So in his 10-year journey, I mean, he basically was taking this, the rotunda, with all the different tons of equipment, his carpenters, his family, and visited, what, you said maybe 20 sites in Europe?
He would have visited more than 20 cities, but we think he set it up, the exhibition up, in about 20 sites or more. We know that he went, for instance, first to Munich, he went to Vienna, Linz. He was in France, northern Germany, Scandinavia, the lowlands. So he really covered a great part of Europe. He traveled by Donau on the Elbe River, where he could, obviously, with such weight of cargo, it was good to travel over the water. And he also traveled over the North Sea part of the way, and also he navigated the Great Belt. So it's a very impressive distance that he covered just to show Salzburg to the world. And we call him really one of the forerunners of tourism for Salzburg. As I mentioned, maybe Salzburg was going through a sleepy period. It was no longer as glamorous as it was under the Prince Archbishops, and it had been overrun by Napoleon's troops in the early 19th century. And for that reason, it was really the perfect time for someone like Sattler to exposed the world to Salzburg by bringing Salzburg to the world. And in 1860, the train connection between Vienna and Salzburg was instated, and the train station was opened. So that makes it especially an interesting time for him to be traveling and getting the word out about the beauty of Salzburg to people who had never seen photographs of it, or especially anything color and of this scale. This is really the only thing that they could have gotten an impression from.
Right. And was he sponsored by, like, the emperor to do this trip, or was this his own doing?
I said it was a commission, but actually, I don't know if you can call it that, because the emperor did not give him any money. He just took the wish of the emperor as a great honor and took it very seriously.
Yeah. And he lived from the money he got from the visitors.
So just basically the income from admissions fees.
Like a moving museum.
Right. Yeah. So it was a moving museum, taking Salzburg on the road in a lot of ways. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Let's go back to the museum. So, how was someone being introduced to Salzburg, and how was someone viewing this?
If they are installed the way that they should be viewed by the public, it's very common to have a panorama building or setting that they could be viewed in a circular form. What's interesting about the Salzburg panorama, one is the quality is so high of the painting, of the image, and also it's a small panorama. As I mentioned, it's only 29 meters long, and some are as long as football fields. Some of the later panoramas are like 100 meters long. And this is very interesting for the viewer because it gives the painting a certain steepness. One thing that I think is fascinating is even today, when we are so desensitized with images, that when you walk onto the platform here, some people say they get a sort of vertigo. Mm. And I think that's really amazing that it still has that effect on us. And that is partially due to the fact that the painting is so small, but for panoramic proportions, and that a lot of the things that you're looking at, like the old city, are actually below your center of gravity. And we can only imagine what kind of effect that would have had on the people who saw the panorama for the first time, especially a public in the early 19th century that had rarely even seen visual images. They would have seen maybe small prints in newspapers, maybe they had seen paintings, but I'm sure the effect was really amazing in some way.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, because I think that's really our interest in looking at the panorama was to see and trace back kind of our meaning in the last two centuries, more or less, our initial exposure to the visual representation of space. And we also know that as cartographic products or maps, but also through landscape paintings. And so some people, would have come here and, like you say, looked down because we're up on a platform and there's about a meter below us. And so we can look down onto the city as if we're from the fortress and feel that vertigo, like you say. People who talk about the history of cartography like to bring in these exhibitions from the world's fairs, panoramas like this one, as representations or as different examples of how we interpreted the spaces we lived in. And so someone, like you say, seeing this in Salzburg is going to see this with their eyes in a lot of a different way than we would see it today. And I think mainly, like you say, because of our relationship to visual images has changed so dramatically over the last maybe 100 years.
Yes, I think we have to really put ourselves in the place of the viewer at the time to imagine what this would have been like for them to see it. This was before the time of motion pictures, and on one hand, it was popular culture. It was, as you maybe said, something that you could view in the context of a fair, but he didn't just install the painting at fairs. He traveled, and probably because its quality being so high, it went beyond that kind of popular culture aspect and was more along the lines of education. People felt probably the need to see the painting to educate themselves about places that they had never seen, and they probably, in many cases, never expected to visit Salzburg, and that made it special for them because it was really their only chance to experience the sublime beauty here that Sattler took with him all over Europe.
Right, so it may be, you mentioned sort of motion pictures as well. This predates the motion picture as a way of, in some ways, entertainment or pop culture, like you're saying. But also, for many people that were never going to travel, maybe outside of their region. And so this gave someone the chance to see that far and abroad. We are privileged to be able to see this magnificent work here, thanks to years of meticulous restoration work. How long did the restoration take, do you know?
It was 4 years, no, 2 years by six people who worked the whole week through.
So a lot of work to restore this.
Yeah. And they had to put away up to six or seven pieces of color to find this original color.
Yeah. And where did they work? Was that here in Salzburg that they did it?
No, in here, in this museum.
All right.
The platform was not yet here,
yeah.
But they had such towers, how you can see at Baustellen. To get on every part of the panorama.
All right.
And they worked with scalpel.
Yeah.
To put away the color that was painted on it through the 150 years.
It was restored constantly because it was a moving work of art. It was something that was in use, and for that reason, people had, in the different generations, used all different kinds of paint to restore the painting, and that was one reason, I think, was it, that they had to use a scalpel and remove things by hand, because you can't chemically remove at the same time all different kinds of paint. So it was very intensive. And that is one reason probably that a lot of panoramas aren't extant today. There are very few in comparison to how many there were in the 19th century, because they were objects of use that were constantly subjected to the elements. They were always in these little portable huts that, you know, had a lot of humidity and moisture. And so that's probably why a lot of them didn't survive. So we're very lucky to have the panorama here in Salzburg.
This is Geographical Imaginations, your tour guide into the geographies of everything and nothing. Make sure to check out archived episodes online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Let's get back to the episode, Peephole Geographies. So another part of the exhibition are the cosmoramas. And who painted the cosmoramas and why?
The cosmoramas were painted by Hubert Sattler, and he was the son of Johann Michael Sattler. He became a very famous painter in his own right, and he had a very interesting education because he traveled as a boy with his family on this 10-year journey with the panorama painting. He and his father got out at the various sites where the panorama was exhibited, and they made a lot of sketches of all the little towns that they passed through on their 10-year journey. So he had a very interesting education. And he later became, as I said, in his own right, a landscape painter, and he specialized in these cosmorama paintings. The cosmorama was originally a part of the panorama exhibit. On the lower level of the rotunda, you walked through a darkened hall and you looked through these little optical lenses that gave you the feeling of looking through a kind of telescope. And on the other side of the wall were these paintings, cosmorama paintings, which were lit from the back. And in that way, the viewer was invited to walk through, ambulate on the lower level of the panorama building, and have this illusion of visiting a different place that they had never seen before. And that was what the cosmoramas were. And Hubert, as an adult, went on to become the absolute master of cosmorama paintings based on what he and his father had done on their trips. And he traveled all over many different places to paint his cosmoramas.
The cosmoramas would have been presented to the public through peepholes, which most likely were installed with optical lenses. And what we're looking at right now is a model of one of those. And perhaps, you know, it could have very likely have looked like this. But you put your eyes up to basically up to two holes and look into a scene. So this is how they would have been.
Yes, this is how you viewed the cosmorama paintings. As I think I might have mentioned, they're lit from the back, and so you had the illusion of looking into the distance and actually seeing this place. And we think that the optical glasses, we don't have any original glasses that Sattler would have not used, but we think that they enhanced the three-dimensional quality of the image and also, of course, gave you the feeling that you were really looking at it.
And the one that we have actually on display here, there's a number of cosmorama paintings, but the one that's on display is actually of Tulum, which is in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, near the border with Belize. And we have a view of an overgrown Tulum, an overgrown pyramid, the ruins of a pyramid. With I'm looking at two horses and three men having a conversation. Two probably or looks like they're guiding one other man through the area, perhaps like the viewer might experience by looking here. And if you sort of move your head around, you could see this whole world here of the Mayan ruins.
How many Kazamaramas were there?
I think it was 200 or 300. And today we have in the storage of the museum about 120. And 24 of them are exhibited to different themes. And we change every year. But they are not all yet restored. But we try one day that all will be restored.
And in terms of, these are far away places, did he actually travel to all of them to paint them?
We think that Hubert traveled to most of the sites that he painted. He was known for that. He went to the Orient. He was in Egypt. He was in Cuba, in the northern United States, and also Mexico, where he painted Tulum. Not necessarily, though, did he always visit the site that he painted. We know, for instance, that he probably never visited the Grand Canyon. He painted, however, a Kazamarama of it late in life, and he probably used a postcard or a lithograph as a model.
But he visited all continents except Australia. We know it. He was a very big traveler, and he really was nearly in every landscapes he showed us with his Kazamaramas.
A lot of the sites that Hubert Sattler painted later had a special interest culturally, and they became UNESCO sites.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they would have been important by the time he painted them, right? Or maybe gained an importance even. I would assume places gain an importance the more times they're painted and more times they circulate through people's imaginations, right? And so more people seeing these Kazamaramas around the world or wherever he traveled with them, the more these places sort of entered into a worldwide, what we call at the show, the geographical imagination, or this mental map, this way of thinking about faraway places, and what, not even just like what they look like, but how they enter into our conceptualization of the globe, and really of humanity and how we all occupy the globe.
This is Geographical Imaginations, your tour guide into the geographies of everything and nothing. Let's walk back from Salzburg Museum to the studio.
So looking through this peephole, we get glimpses of the faraway places. We see proof, evidence that they exist. The world maybe becomes smaller. These places we've read about become visual. They enter into an imagination, a way of thinking about the world. I have with me Dr. Patrick Schouty, whose work on exhibit last month in the fortress, ironically enough, atop Mönchsberg here in Salzburg, really caught my eye as one of those examples that one looks for to help explain some concept or theory, but one never could really put their finger on it. Interestingly enough, his work was on display there, that same fortress that Johann Sattler painted his panorama from, and that we get to see Salzburg from in the panorama. I connect the two segments tonight in a loose fashion, but their contact points are both physical in sharing this fortress and faraway places in common, and conceptual in that they both introduce a world, perhaps on the other side of the door and through the peephole. Patrick's photographs, and I'm paraphrasing here from the description of his last exhibition, are not snapshots of the decisive moment like Cartier-Bresson's work. Remember, he extracts that instant from the continuity of time. But Patrick's work, his pinhole photographs, reveal time spaces in which the duration is made visible in multiple layers or depths of time. He calls it the topography of time.
Patrick's, a lot of his work in photography, as I mentioned, really does works with the pinhole technique. And I wanted to hear from him specifically how the pinhole technique works and a little bit of its history.
Yeah, it's a really simple kind of camera technique, maybe the Stone Age camera. It's a lead-tight container, a box or a can, or you can make it out of wood or whatever you want. And you're using a really small hole you're making with a needle. And for me, the most interesting part in using a technique like this, or a reduced technique like this, is to limit the possibilities you can choose to make your pictures.
Through this pinhole, we're able to capture, and I'm looking at some of your photographs here, we're able to capture some of the movement, or perhaps even the tracings of movement, or the tracks that the things that are moving, and are in this case, in many of your photographs that we're looking at, are people, the movement of people. We're able to sort of capture that in the photograph. And so, for instance, in the photograph in the museum here, this is a museum in Paris, and we're seeing in some areas what looks like the residue or the trace or these layers of where people were. So how would you describe what we're seeing there? I mean, is that just the presence of people? But what else, what beyond that is that?
For me, the main theme or the main factor in my photographs is the time. So these layers you were talking about is mainly, in my idea, are layers of time and temporality. Sure, you can do long time exposures with every camera you want, but for me, the special thing with the pinhole camera is that long time exposures are the only thing you can do, because we're talking about a pinhole with a maybe 2 or 3 tenths of a millimeter in diameter. So it's really a small opening you're using, and for that, time is becoming really an important factor in the making of the picture. And yeah, so for me the main thing one can see in the picture is the changings and the duration of time at that places I'm taking pictures of.
Right. And how long sometimes is that duration?
It's depending on the light situation and the materials I use. So it can be some seconds, maybe 10 or 20 seconds. And it can also be minutes, hours. And yeah, you can extend the exposure to years if you like to.
What's the longest you've ever done an exposure? How long?
The longest I did and I really get a usable photograph out, it was 1 year. So you can really see more or less the changes. I took pictures outside, so you'd see the changes in nature. Not in the details, but in the change the change of time itself. Mm-hmm. So it's a strange idea.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information, check us out on the web at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back with Patrick Shouty. So capture in 1 year, you really get to see the seasonal change, whereas in these shorter ones, how about the... Again, looking at the art museum in Paris, what
time frame, what exposure did you have for that? How long was that?
Maybe 2 or 3 minutes, 5 minutes, maybe.
2 or 3 minutes, so yeah.
Shorter period.
Right.
But also it's like, especially in the museum photographs, for me, the camera is becoming a instrument for measuring the interest people take in artwork. And so it's also, you know, having a period of some minutes for the exposure. It's a good, how do you call it, interval,
uh-huh,
for a place like this where people come and look at art, at pictures.
But it isn't, right, it's an interval of time, it's a sample, maybe to sound even like a more scientific, right? There's a sample of time, maybe 5 minutes long, where you really get to see, so where we're seeing sort of what we might say blobs of people or a lot of sort of layering happening. Now, what's happening there? That's where more people are circulating? And is it also like where more people maybe spend more time too?
Yeah, it's different, especially you have lots and lots of people at the Louvre that are like tourists, you know, everyone has to go there and they are just running through all the important rooms. And beside that, you have people who are really interested or, yeah, they are looking at special pictures for a longer time. And so you get different things. You get some soft foggy areas where lots of people are moving kind of fast or quickly, and you got more or less transparent images of people who are, yeah, sitting or standing in a place for longer periods.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mixture of both, you know, the really permanently movement and also the stop and go of people watching.
Right. I mean, do you think of it, and I, as a geographer, love just the idea of maps, but also this sort of, you know, borrowing from that sort of thinking. Is this a way of mapping out people's movement by using this pinhole technique? I mean, do you think of it as, in that cartographic way, as in some way a map of people's paths or tracks, perhaps?
Yeah, actually, in these photographs or in this series of photographs, it was, when making it, it was nice because you really have rooms that are really crowded around the Mona Lisa. You cannot even put the camera somewhere. And you have other rooms where nobody is coming. So also from this, and I took pictures in both extremes, let's say. And so I was thinking about, you know, having this series of photographs like a time map in some kind, or also a map of the interests,
right,
where people go and why they go there. And yeah, again, time is the most important part in the work.
Yeah, right. I'm just thinking like in cartography and some of the basic sort of rules we use, especially when we're trying to show the differences between defined areas. There's something that's called a choropleth map. And so if we were, for instance, just to give you an example, here in Europe, if we were to talk about access to internet by percentage or by, let's say, number of people or number of households per 1,000, households over 300 in or countries that have that rate of households 300 or more per 1,000 would be colored in a dark color, right? And then in countries that had households maybe between 200 and 300 would be a lighter color, between 100 and 200 even a lighter color, and then sub or below 100 would be the lightest color. And it would be on a range of a color scale. And generally, a lot of times in these maps, it's from like a yellow to an orange to a red to a really dark maroon. And so I'm looking at this and kind of thinking in a similar fashion, we're seeing what's left imprinted on your film then is lighter to darker, right?
Yeah.
In some ways, right? Lighter to darker. And I'm not saying in the very same fashion as a choropleth map. No, of course not. But it's this imprint left on the film, and it's darker where there was some stillness in some ways. Or is it the stillness? I guess some stillness, which meant a pause. And then...
No, it's also in areas where more people are standing and moving at the same place, not simultaneously, but one after the other. And they can also be there for short times or different times. You will get more layers of these people, and they will get kind of darker or more... tense.
Mm-hmm.
Then in areas where only few people are moving more or less quickly, you will maybe have some drag or some however ghostly image of the movement.
Right.
But where people are stopping at more or less the same place, they will put their layers or they will leave their layers.
Right.
One over the other, and so they will get the darker areas there.
Right. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations. This is episode 2, Peephole Geography.
I think I'm not trying to show something really new in my pictures. So I show, I think, places everyone knows, or at least some similar places like streets or museums or big places in cities.
Right.
But I try to, rediscover them with a pinhole camera and maybe produce some irritation through the emptiness, or also these traces, whatever you call it, of the movement of the time, the changes in time that are at these places. And so that's the main idea, more or less.
The tracks might show us then proof.
No, and that's also, maybe in the connection with the panorama or classically painting, like in these viewing boxes,
right?
It's the promise of evidence that something has been or is like that in a picture. If it's a painting from the 17th or whatever. it was a proof that there are pyramids in Mexico or in Egypt, or how the places in America and somewhere around the world are looking. And with photography, it was even a bigger promise of being realistic about these impressions that you're seeing. And maybe that's also one of the irritating points in my pinhole pictures, that it's also a proof of the reality of the place, but in a different kind of way. So it's more or less breaking apart from the obvious evidence that something special has been there at some past moment. Like Roland Barthes worked it out in his Camera Lucida.
Uh-huh.
His book. as the specific photographical matter, this,
the punctum,
yeah, the also this, but the yeah, the point that whatever you take a picture of has been there whenever, but it's something that lies in the past. At a special moment when the picture was taken, something has been at that place at that moment, but it's not a, really a proof that it's still there, but it's a proof that it has been there.
Hmm.
And if you extend the moment into a duration, it's also a proof in my pictures that at the time of making the photographs, things have left their tracks in the picture. Things have been there. But it's it's not so much a proof for the moment, but for a how can I say? Yeah, for whatever.
My conversation with Patrick was fun as we explored his photography and as we sought out a common lexicon or vocabulary for the concepts and theme and themes running through his work. And we came to this.
No, I think more, as I said before, it's that the pictures are not layers of moments, but that the pictures are time spaces. Because also the time-space continuum that we know
mm-hmm.
since Einstein.
Right.
These two parts are directly connected to each other. And thinking of the pinhole camera or the camera obscura, like it was used in the Renaissance to in the arts, for producing the depth of the space in the in a perspective in the pictures, maybe also rooted in this idea, it's more the time space, the depth of time that is that gets visible in my pictures.
Right, the depth of time. You're capturing, let's go back to like this idea of like the stillness and the movement. I mean, you're capturing that which is still, or that which even temporarily pauses. But sort of at the same time, it then clues us in or shows us, because it's leaving some trace, it's showing us the movement. And might even clue us into how fast or how temporary that pause really was. I'm talking maybe more back now to the less so the Mexico City example, but talking more about the museum example, because it's showing us the photograph. I'm sorry, the paintings, just as much as we would see in any short exposure digital camera or any kind, right? But it's leaving that sort of spectral, or when I first saw this, I thought it was kind of ghost-like, right? But we're not taking pictures of ghosts, but we're seeing this perhaps a residue or the tracings that are left behind by people's movement. And the faster you move, the less likely you're going to leave anything behind, right? And so it's registering like the contemplation almost in a museum setting. It's that you've sat there and looked at and asked questions in your head while standing in front of some work, some painting, some sculpture. That said, it's also registering the number of people maybe in a space, because that's when we start to see, not so much in human form, but just sort of fuzzy, foggy looking sort of larger, I would say a blob, but it's also just, we know it's people because we could see some of the other more clearer images really resembling people. So we could kind of make that visual assumption that the others are people. It's a stillness that gets captured. And so it's capturing a certain speed and not others. This has been another episode of Geographical Imaginations, Peephole Geographies, Episode 2. I want to thank our guests for volunteering their time at the Salzburg Museum, art historians Renata Lagenfelder and Deborah Gatewood. Thanks for showing us a little bit of the history of the visual image and how it's informed the ways in which many learned about Salzburg and places far away through the Kosmoramas. Also, I'd like to thank Patrick Schaudy for showing us behind the veil and through the pinhole, and looking at what gets exposed through the pinhole technique are time spaces. So thanks to all of our guests. I'd also like to thank, as always, Mike Allen, and for the use of his song for our show, Driftfield Beats, which is what you've heard in the background all throughout. We look forward to next episode. We'll have another artist talk, and this time for most of the episode, actually. So we'll be speaking with German artist Berthe Endriat, who's a member of the art collective Mark, who was here in Salzburg working recently on a project. So without any further, I'd like to say let's see you next time. Ciao. Que les vaya bien.